This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption by Laura Hillenbrand. This is Edward Herman. What stays with you latest and deepest? Of curious panics, of hard-fought engagements or sieges tremendous, what deepest remains? Walt Whitman, The Wound Dresser. Preface. All he could see, in every direction, was water. It was June 23, 1943. Somewhere on the endless expanse of the Pacific Ocean, Army Air Force's bombardier and Olympic runner, Louis Zamperini, lay across a small raft, drifting westward. Slumped alongside him was a sergeant, one of his plane's gunners. On a separate raft, tethered to the first, lay another crewman, a gash zigzagging across his forehead. Their bodies, burned by the sun and stained yellow from the raft dye, had winnowed down to skeletons. Sharks glided in lazy loops around them, dragging their backs along the rafts, waiting. The men had been adrift for 27 days. Borne by an equatorial current, they had floated at least 1,000 miles, deep into Japanese-controlled waters. The rafts were beginning to deteriorate into jelly and gave off a sour, burning odor. The men's bodies were pocked with salt sores, and their lips were so swollen that they pressed into their nostrils and chins. They spent their days with their eyes fixed on the sky, singing White Christmas, muttering about food. No one was even looking for them anymore. They were alone on 64 million square miles of ocean. A month earlier, 26-year-old Zamperini had been one of the greatest runners in the world, expected by many to be the first to break the 4-minute mile, one of the most celebrated barriers in sport. Now his Olympian's body had wasted to less than 100 pounds, and his famous legs could no longer lift him. Almost everyone, outside of his family, had given him up for dead. On that morning of the 27th day, the men heard a distant, deep strumming. Every airman knew that sound. Pistons. Their eyes caught a glint in the sky, a plane high overhead. Zamperini fired two flares and shook powder dye into the water, enveloping the rafts in a circle of vivid orange. The plane kept going, slowly disappearing. The men sagged. Then the sound returned, and the plane came back into view. The crew had seen them. With arms shrunken to little more than bone and yellowed skin, the castaways waved and shouted, their voices thin from thirst. The plane dropped low and swept alongside the rafts. Zamperini saw the profiles of the crewmen, dark against bright blueness. There was a terrific roaring sound. The water and the rafts themselves seemed to boil. It was machine gun fire. This was not an American rescue plane. It was a Japanese bomber. The men pitched themselves into the water and hung together under the rafts, cringing as bullets punched through the rubber and sliced effervescent lines in the water around their faces. The firing blazed on, then sputtered out as the bomber overshot them. The men dragged themselves back onto the one raft that was still mostly inflated. The bomber banked sideways, circling toward them again. As it leveled off, Zamperini could see the muzzles of the machine guns aimed directly at them. Zamperini looked toward his crewmates. They were too weak to go back in the water. As they lay down on the floor of the raft, hands over their heads, Zamperini splashed overboard alone. Somewhere beneath him, the sharks were done waiting. They bent their bodies in the water and swam toward the man under the raft. Part 1. Chapter 1. The One Boy Insurgency. In the pre-dawn darkness of August 26, 1929, in the back bedroom of a small house in Torrance, California, a 12-year-old boy sat up in bed listening. There was a sound coming from outside, growing ever louder. It was a huge, heavy rush, suggesting immensity, a great parting of air. It was coming from directly above the house. The boy swung his legs off his bed, raced down the stairs, slapped open the back door, and loped onto the grass. The yard was otherworldly, smothered in unnatural darkness, shivering with sound. The boy stood on the lawn beside his older brother, head thrown back, spellbound. The sky had disappeared. An object that he could see only in silhouette, reaching across a massive arc of space, was suspended low in the air over the house. It was longer than 2.5 football fields and as tall as a city. It was putting out the stars. What he saw was the German dirigible Graf Zeppelin. At nearly 800 feet long and 110 feet high, it was the largest flying machine ever crafted. More luxurious than the finest airplane, gliding effortlessly over huge distances, built on a scale that left spectators gasping, it was, in the summer of 29, the wonder of the world. The airship was 3 days from completing a sensational feat of aeronautics, circumnavigation of the globe. The journey had begun on August 7th, when the Zeppelin had slipped its tethers in Lakehurst, New Jersey, lifted up with a long, slow sigh, and headed for Manhattan. On Fifth Avenue that summer, demolition was soon to begin on the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, clearing the way for a skyscraper of unprecedented proportions, the Empire State Building. At Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, players were debuting numbered uniforms. Lou Gehrig wore number 4. Babe Ruth, about to hit his 500th home run, wore number 3. On Wall Street, stock prices were racing toward an all-time high. After a slow glide around the Statue of Liberty, the Zeppelin banked north, then turned out over the Atlantic. In time, land came below again. France, Switzerland, Germany. The ship passed over Nuremberg, where fringe politician Adolf Hitler, whose Nazi party had been trounced in the 1928 elections, had just delivered a speech touting selective infanticide. Then it flew east to Frankfurt, where a Jewish woman named Edith Frank was caring for her newborn, a girl named Anne. Sailing northeast, the Zeppelin crossed over Russia. Siberian villagers, so isolated that they'd never even seen a train, fell to their knees at the sight of it. On August 19th, as some 4 million Japanese waved handkerchiefs and shouted Banzai, the Zeppelin circled Tokyo and sank onto a landing field. 4 days later, as the German and Japanese anthems played, the ship rose into the grasp of a typhoon that whisked it over the Pacific at breathtaking speed toward America. Passengers, gazing from the window, saw only the ship's shadow, following it along the clouds, like a huge shark swimming alongside. When the clouds parted, the passengers glimpsed giant creatures turning in the sea that looked like monsters. On August 25th, the Zeppelin reached San Francisco. After being cheered down the California coast, it slid through sunset into darkness and silence and across midnight. As slow as the drifting wind, it passed over Torrance, where its only audience was a scattering of drowsy souls, among them the boy in his pajamas behind the house on Gramercy Avenue. Standing under the airship, his feet bare in the grass, he was transfixed. It was, he would say, fearfully beautiful. He could feel the rumble of the craft's engines tilling the air, but couldn't make out the silver skin, the sweeping ribs, the finned tail. He could see only the blackness of the space it inhabited. It was not a great presence, but a great absence, a geometric ocean of darkness that seemed to swallow heaven itself. The boy's name was Louis Silvier Zamperini. The son of Italian immigrants, he had come into the world in Olean, New York, on January 26, 1917, 11.5 pounds of baby under black hair as coarse as barbed wire. His father, Anthony, had been living on his own since age 14, first as a coal miner and boxer, then as a construction worker. His mother, Louise, was a petite, playful beauty, 16 at marriage and 18 when Louis was born. In their apartment, where only Italian was spoken, Louise and Anthony called their boy Toots. Chapter 8. Only the laundry knew how scared I was. It was early morning on January 8, 1943. The sun hadn't yet risen. George Mosnett and James Carringer, who had spent New Year's Eve with Louis, joined their crew at the beachside airstrip at Barking Sands on Kauai, preparing to lead a 3-plane training run over Pearl Harbor. The pilot was Major Jonathan Coxwell, one of Phil's closest friends. As he taxied out for his flight, Coxwell tried to reach the control tower, but the tower's radio was down. He powered his plane down the runway, lifted off, and flew over the beach and into the darkness. The two other planes took off after Coxwell. Later that morning, they returned. Coxwell's plane did not. No one had seen it since takeoff. During a briefing at 8, Louis was told that Coxwell's plane was missing. Phil's crew was slated for practice bombing off Barking Sands that morning, so they went early and walked the beach, looking for some sign of their friends. Someone found a $400 paycheck that had washed ashore. It was made out to Masnet. The Superman crew was 15,000 feet up when the lost B-24 was found, lying on the ocean floor, not far offshore. All 10 crewmen were dead. Coxwell had barely made it past takeoff. He had cleared the runway, turned, and slammed into the water. Several crewmen had survived the crash and tried to swim to land, but the sharks had found them. The men were, Louis wrote in his diary, literally ripped to pieces. 5, including Masnet, had lived in the pornographic palace with Louis and Phil. Carringer had just been promoted to first lieutenant, but had died before anyone could tell him. They were buried in the cemetery in Honolulu, joining the men killed at Pearl Harbor. Louis was shaken. He'd been in Hawaii for only 2 months, yet already several dozen men from his bomb group, including more than a quarter of the men in his barracks, had been killed. The first loss had come on the flight from San Francisco, when a B-24 had simply vanished. This fate was sadly common. Between 1943 and 1945, 400 AAF crews were lost en route to their theaters. Next, a plane had caught fire and crashed in Kahuku, killing 4 men. Another plane had hit a mountain. A bomber had been forced down after losing all 4 engines, killing 2. In one bomber, a green engineer transferring fuel across the wings had caused gasoline to pool on the floor of the bomb bay. When the bomb bay doors had scraped open, igniting a spark, the plane exploded. 3 men had survived, including a passenger whose hand had happened to be resting on a parachute when the blast flung him from the plane. After the wake raid, a plane sent to photograph the damage had been hit by anti-aircraft fire. The crew had sent out a last message, "Can't make it," and was never heard from again. Then had come Coxwell's crash. These losses, only one due to enemy action, were hardly anomalous. In World War II, 35,933 AAF planes were lost in combat and accidents. The surprise of the attrition rate is that only a fraction of the ill-fated planes were lost in combat. In 1943, in the Pacific Ocean Areas Theater, in which Phil's crew served, for every plane lost in combat, some 6 planes were lost in accidents. Over time, combat took a greater toll, but combat losses never overtook non-combat losses. As planes went, so went men. In the Air Corps, 35,946 personnel died in non-battle situations, the vast majority of them in accidental crashes. Even in combat, airmen appear to have been more likely to die from accidents than combat itself. A report issued by the AAF Surgeon General suggests that in the 15th Air Force, between November 1, 1943, and May 25, 1945, 70% of men listed as killed in action died in operational aircraft accidents, not as a result of enemy action. In many cases, the problem was the planes, in part because they were new technology, and in part because they were used so heavily, planes were prone to breakdowns. In January 1943 alone, Louis recorded in his diary 10 serious mechanical problems in Superman and other planes in which he flew, including 2 in-flight engine failures, a gas leak, oil pressure problems, and landing gear that locked, fortunately, in the down position. Once, Superman's brakes failed on landing. By the time Phil got the plane stopped, the bomber was 3 feet short of the runway's end. Just beyond it lay the ocean. The weather also took a toll. Storms reduced visibility to 0, a major problem for pilots searching for tiny islands or threading through the mountains that flanked some Hawaiian runways. B-24s were hard to manage even in smooth skies. In some tropical tempests, not even the combined strength of pilot and co-pilot could keep the plane in hand. Twice in 1 week, Superman flew into storms that buffeted the plane so violently that Phil lost control. Once, the plane was flung around the sky for 10 minutes, leaving the temporary co-pilot so paralyzed with fear that Phil had to call Louis to take his place. One day, after sea search, as Phil was detouring around a squall, Cuppernell asked him if he'd dare fly into it. "I can fly this thing anywhere," Phil said, turning the plane into the storm. Superman was instantly swallowed, and Phil could see nothing. Rain drummed on the plane, wind pivoted it sideways, and it began porpoising, leaving the crewmen clinging to anything bolted down. They had only been at 1,000 feet when they'd flown into the storm. Now the plane was pitching so erratically that they couldn't read their altitude, and with no visibility, they didn't know where the ocean was. Each time the plane plunged, the men braced for a crash. Oahu had been in sight before they entered the storm, but now they had no idea where it was. Phil gripped the yoke, sweat streaming down his face. Pillsbury strapped on his parachute. Riding the bucking plane at his radio table, Harry Brooks picked up a signal from a Hawaiian radio station. The plane was equipped with a radio compass that enabled Harry to determine the direction from which the signal was coming. Phil strong-armed the plane around and headed toward it. They broke out of the storm, found the airfield, and landed. Phil was exhausted, his shirt wringing wet. The runways were another headache. Many islands were so short that engineers had to plow coral onto one end to create enough length for a runway. Even with the amendments, there often wasn't enough space. After long missions, groups of planes occasionally came back so low on fuel that none of them could wait for the others to land, so they'd land simultaneously, with the lead pilot delaying his touchdown until he was far enough down the runway for the planes behind him to land at the same time. So many planes shot off the end of Funafuti's runway and into the ocean that the ground crews kept a bulldozer equipped with a towing cable parked by the water. For loaded B-24s, which needed well over 4,000 feet for takeoff, the cropped island runways, often abutted by towering palm trees, were a challenge. "The takeoff proved exciting," wrote Staff Sergeant Frank Rozenek of one overloaded departure. "Six of us had to stand on the narrow beam between the bomb bay doors with our arms spread out on each side over the tops of the twin auxiliary fuel tanks. The smell of the high-octane aviation fuel was almost intoxicating. The plane lumbered down the runway for an eternity, and we could see the hard-packed coral through the cracks where the bomb bay doors came up against the beam we were standing on, 1 foot in front of the other. There was a swoosh, and pieces of palm frond suddenly appeared jammed in the cracks on both sides. Only the laundry knew how scared I was." And then there was human error. Pilots flew or drove their planes into each other. In B-24s, notorious for fuel leaks, airmen lit cigarettes and blew up their planes. On one flight, when Superman's number 3 engine died, Pillsbury found the temporary co-pilot, oblivious, sitting with his boot resting against the engine's ignition switch, pushing it into the off position. Louis was once asked to join a crew whose bombardier had gotten sick. Louis, too, was feeling ill, so the crew found another man. During the flight, the tower warned the pilot that he was heading toward a mountain. The pilot replied that he saw it, then flew right into it. The strangest incident occurred when a bomber made a sharp pull-up on a training run. A man inside, trying to avoid falling, inadvertently grabbed the life raft release handle. The raft sprang from the roof and wrapped around the plane's horizontal stabilizer. Barely able to control the plane, the pilot ordered his men to bail out. He and his co-pilot somehow landed safely, and everyone survived. Finally, there was the formidable difficulty of navigation. Making extraordinarily complex spherical trigonometry calculations based on figures taken from a crowd of instruments, navigators groped over thousands of miles of featureless ocean toward targets or destination islands that were blacked out at night, often only yards wide and flat to the horizon. Even with all the instruments, the procedures could be comically primitive. "Each time I made a sextant calibration," wrote navigator John Weller, "I would open the escape hatch on the flight deck and stand on my navigation desk and the radio operator's desk while the radio man held onto my legs so I would not be sucked out of the plane. At night, navigators sometimes resorted to following the stars, guiding their crews over the Pacific by means not so different from those used by ancient Polynesian mariners. In a storm or clouds, even that was impossible. Given that a plane had to be only a tick off course to miss an island, it's amazing that any crews found their destinations. Many didn't. Martin Cohn, an ordnance officer on Oahu, was once in a radar shack as a lost plane, unequipped with radar, tried to find the island. "We just sat there and watched the plane pass the island, and it never came back," he said. "I could see it on the radar. It makes you feel terrible. Life was cheap in war." The risks of flying were compounded exponentially in combat. From the sky came Japanese fighters, chief among them the swift, agile Zero, which dominated the sky in the first half of the war. Zero pilots pummeled bombers with machine gun fire and massively destructive 20-millimeter cannon shells, which rammed gaping holes in their targets. When these failed, some Zero pilots rammed their planes into bombers, kamikaze style. One B-24 returned to base with half of a Zero hanging from his wing. From the ground came anti-aircraft fire, including flak, which burst into razor-sharp metal shards that sliced planes open. To survive AA fire and enemy aircraft, bomber pilots needed to change their altitude and direction constantly. But on approach, the Norden bombsight, not the pilot, flew the plane, so evasive action was impossible. B-24s were in the control of the bombsight for 3 to 5 minutes on approach. Japanese rangefinders needed less than 60 seconds to pinpoint bomber altitude. The math favored the Japanese. In combat, bombers even posed risks to one another. To fend off fighter attack and hit narrow target islands, planes had to bunch very close together. In the chaos, planes collided, fired on each other, and worse. In one incident, 3 B-24s on a mission to mine a harbor flew in tight formation through a narrow canyon at 50 feet under intense ground fire. As they dropped over the harbor, the right wingtip of a plane piloted by Lieutenant Robert Strong struck the greenhouse window on the plane to his right, piloted by a Lieutenant Robinson. The collision rotated Strong's bomber onto its left side and under Robinson's plane, just as Robinson's bombardier dropped a 1,000-pound mine. The mine crashed into Strong's plane, and though it didn't detonate, it tore an 18-square-foot hole in the fuselage and lodged itself just behind the waist gunners. Strong's B-24 was nearly cut in two, and the mine's parachute deployed, dragging the plane down. Crewmen cut the parachute free and shoved at the mine, but it wouldn't budge. So they dismantled their guns and used the barrels to crowbar the mine out. As Strong tried to get the nearly bisected plane home, the tail flapped in the wind and a huge crack crept up the fuselage. Impossibly, Strong flew his Liberator 800 miles and landed. When Jesse Stay, a pilot in Louis' squadron, went to see the bomber, he was nearly able to pull its tail off with one hand. The risks of combat created grim statistics. In World War II, 52,173 AAF men were killed in combat. According to Stay, who would become a squadron commander, airmen trying to fulfill the 40 combat missions that made up a Pacific bomber crewman's tour of duty had a 50% chance of being killed. Along with safe return, injury, and death, airmen faced another possible fate. During the war, thousands of airmen vanished. Some during combat missions, some on routine flights. Many had been swallowed by the ocean. Some were alive, but lost on the sea or islands. And some had been captured. Unable to find them, the military declared them missing. If they weren't found within 13 months, they were declared dead. Most of the time, stricken Pacific bombers came down on water, either by ditching or by crashing. Crewmen who crashed were very unlikely to survive, but ditching offered better odds, depending on the bomber. The B-17 and its soon-to-be-introduced cousin, the gigantic B-29, had wide, low wings that, with the fuselage, formed a relatively flat surface that could surf onto water. Their sturdy bomb bay doors sat flush to the fuselage, intended to hold in a ditching, enabling the plane to float. The first ditched B-29 not only survived, it floated onto an Indian beach completely intact the following day. The B-24 was another story. Its wings were narrow and mounted high on the fuselage, and its delicate bombay doors protruded slightly from the bottom of the plane. In most B-24 ditchings, the bombay doors would catch on the water and tear off, and the plane would blow apart. Less than a quarter of ditched B-17s broke up, but a survey of B-24 ditchings found that nearly two-thirds broke up and a quarter of the crewmen died. For B-24 survivors, quick escape was crucial. Without sealed fuselages, Liberators sank instantly. One airman recalled watching his ditched B-24 sink so quickly that he could still see its lights when it was far below the surface. Every airman was given a Mae West life vest, but because some men stole the vest's carbon dioxide cartridges for use in carbonating drinks, some vests didn't inflate. Life rafts were deployed manually. From inside the plane, crewmen could pull a release handle just before ditching or crashing. From outside a floating plane, they could climb on the wings and turn raft release levers. Once deployed, rafts inflated automatically. Survivors had to get to rafts immediately. Airmen would later speak of sharks arriving almost the moment that their planes struck the water. In 1943, Navy Lieutenant Art Redding, Louis' USC track teammate, was knocked unconscious as he ditched his two-man plane. As the plane sank, Redding's navigator, Everett Almond, pulled Redding out, inflated their Mae Wests, and lashed himself to Redding. As Redding woke, Almond began towing him toward the nearest island, 20 miles away. Sharks soon began circling. One swept in, bit down on Almond's leg, and dove, dragging both men deep underwater. Then something gave way and the men rose to the surface in a pool of blood. Almond's leg had apparently been torn off. He gave his Mae West to Redding, then sank away. For the next 18 hours, Redding floated alone, kicking at the sharks and hacking at them with his binoculars. By the time a search boat found him, his legs were slashed and his jaw broken by the fin of a shark, but thanks to Almond, he was alive. Almond, who had died at 21, was nominated for a posthumous medal for bravery. Everyone had heard stories like Redding's, and everyone had looked from their planes to see sharks roaming below. The fear of sharks was so powerful that most men, faced with the choice of riding a crippled plane to a ditching or bailing out, chose to take their chances in a ditching, even in the B-24. At least that would leave them near the rafts. The military was dedicated to finding crash and ditching survivors, but in the sprawling Pacific theater, the odds of rescue were extremely daunting. Many doomed planes sent no distress call, and often no one knew a plane was down until it missed its estimated time of arrival, which could be as long as 16 hours after the crash. If the absence went unnoticed until night, an air search couldn't be commenced until morning. In the meantime, raft-bound men struggled with injuries and exposure and drifted far from their crash site. For rescuers, figuring out where to look was tremendously difficult. To keep radio silence, many crews didn't communicate any position during flights. So all searchers had to go on was the course the plane would have followed had everything gone right. But downed planes had often been flying over huge distances and may have veered hundreds of miles off course. Once a plane was down, currents and wind could carry a raft dozens of miles a day. Because of this, search areas often extended over thousands of square miles. The longer rafts floated, the farther they drifted, and the worse the odds of rescue became. The most heartbreaking fact was that if searchers were lucky enough to fly near a raft, chances were good that they wouldn't see it. Rafts for small planes were the size of small bathtubs. Those for large planes were the length of a reclining man. Though search planes generally flew at just 1,000 feet, even from that height, a raft could easily be mistaken for a white cap or a glint of light. On days with low clouds, nothing could be seen at all. Many planes used for rescue searches had high stall speeds, so they had to be flown so fast that crewmen barely had a moment to scan each area before it was gone behind them. In mid-1944, in response to the dismal results of Pacific rescue searches, the AAF implemented a vastly enhanced rescue system. Life rafts were stocked with radios and better provisions. Boats were set out along paths flown by military planes, and searches were handled by designated rescue squadrons equipped with float planes. These advances improved the odds of rescue, but even after their advent, most downed men were never found. According to reports made by the Far East Air Force air surgeon, Fewer than 30% of men whose planes went missing between July 1944 and February 1945 were rescued. Even when the plane's location was known, only 46% of men were saved. In some months, the picture was far worse. In January 1945, only 21 of 167 downed 21st Bomber Command airmen were rescued, just 13%. As bleak as these odds were late in the war, men who went down before mid-1944 faced far worse. Flying before the rescue system was modernized, they faced a situation in which searches were disorganized, life rafts poorly equipped, and procedures ineffective. Everyone on Phil's crew knew that should they go down, their chances of rescue were very low. The improbability of rescue, coupled with the soaring rate of accidental crashes, created a terrible equation. Search planes appear to have been more likely to go down themselves than find the men they were looking for. In one time frame, in the Eastern Air Command, half of the Catalina flying boats attempting rescues crashed while trying to land on the ocean. It seems likely that for every man rescued, several would-be rescuers died, especially in the first years of the war. With every day that passed without rescue, the prospects for raft-bound men worsened dramatically. Raft provisions lasted a few days at most. Hunger, thirst, and exposure to blistering sun by day and chill by night depleted survivors with frightening rapidity. Some men died in days, others went insane. In September 1942, a B-17 crashed in the Pacific, stranding 9 men on a raft. Within a few days, one had died, and the rest had gone mad. 2 heard music and baying dogs. 1 was convinced that a Navy plane was pushing the raft from behind. 2 scuffled over an imaginary case of beer. Another shouted curses at a sky that he believed was full of bombers. Seeing a delusory boat, he pitched himself overboard and drowned. On day 6, when a plane flew by, the remaining men had to confer to be sure that it was real. When they were rescued on day 7, they were too weak to wave their arms. There were fates even worse than this. In February 1942, a wooden raft was found drifting near Christmas Island in the Indian Ocean. Upon it was the body of a man, lying in a makeshift coffin that appeared to have been built on the raft. The man's boiler suit had been in the sun for so long that its blue fabric had been bleached white. A shoe that didn't belong to the man lay beside him. No one ever determined who he was or where he had come from. Of all the horrors facing downed men, the one outcome that they feared most was capture by the Japanese. The roots of the men's fear lay in an event that occurred in 1937, in the early months of Japan's invasion of China. The Japanese military surrounded the city of Nanking, stranding more than 500,000 civilians and 90,000 Chinese soldiers. The soldiers surrendered and, assured of their safety, submitted to being bound. Japanese officers then issued a written order: all prisoners of war are to be executed. What followed was a 6-week frenzy of killing that defies articulation. Masses of POWs were beheaded, machine-gunned, bayoneted, and burned alive. The Japanese turned on civilians, engaging in killing contests, raping tens of thousands of people, mutilating and crucifying them, and provoking dogs to maul them. Japanese soldiers took pictures of themselves posing alongside hacked-up bodies, severed heads, and women strapped down for rape. The Japanese press ran tallies of the killing contests as if they were baseball scores, praising the heroism of the contestants. Historians estimate that the Japanese military murdered between 200,000 and 430,000 Chinese, including the 90,000 POWs, in what became known as the Rape of Nanking. Every American airman knew about Nanking, and since then, Japan had only reinforced the precedent. Among the men of Louis' squadron, there was a rumor circulating about the atoll of Kwajalein in the Marshall Islands, a Japanese territory. On Kwajalein, the rumor said POWs were murdered. The men called it Execution Island. It is testament to the reputation of the Japanese that of all the men in one fatally damaged B-24 falling over Japanese forces, only one chose to bail out. The rest were so afraid of capture that they chose to die in the crash. For airmen, the risks were impossible to shrug off. The dead weren't numbers on a page. They were their roommates, their drinking buddies, the crew that had been flying off their wing 10 seconds ago. Men didn't go one by one. A quarter of a barracks was lost at once. There were rarely funerals, for there were rarely bodies. Men were just gone, and that was the end of it. Airmen avoided the subject of death, but privately, many were tormented by fear. One man in Louis' squadron had chronic stress-induced nosebleeds. Another had to be relieved because he froze with terror in the air. Pilot Joe Deasy recalled a distraught airman who came to him with a question. If a crewman went mad during a mission, would the crew shoot him? The man was so jittery that he accidentally fired his sidearm into the ground as he spoke. Some men were certain that they'd be killed. Others lived in denial. For Louis and Phil, there was no avoiding the truth. After only 2 months and one combat mission, 5 of their friends were already dead, and they had survived several near misses themselves. Their room and icebox, inherited from friends whose bodies were now in the Pacific, were constant reminders. Before Louis had left the States, he'd been issued an olive drab Bible. He tried reading it to cope with his anxiety, but it made no sense to him, and he abandoned it. Instead, he soothed himself by listening to classical music on his phonograph. He often left Phil sprawled on his bed, penning letters to Cece on an upturned box, as he headed out to run off his worries on the mile-long course that he had measured in the sand around the runway. He also tried to prepare for every contingency. He went to the machine shop, cut a thick metal slab, lugged it to Superman, and plunked it down in the greenhouse in hopes that it would protect him from ground fire. He took classes on island survival and wound care, and found a course in which an elderly Hawaiian offered tips on fending off sharks. Open eyes wide and bare teeth. Make football-style stiff arm. Bop shark in nose. And like everyone else, Louis and Phil drank. After a few beers, Louis said it was possible to briefly forget dead friends. Men were given a ration of 4 beers a week, but everyone scoured the landscape for alternatives. Alcohol was to Louis what acorns are to squirrels. He consumed what he wanted when he found it and hid the rest. In training, he had stashed his hooch in a shaving cream bottle. Once deployed, he graduated to mayonnaise jars and ketchup bottles. He stowed a bottle of a local rotgut called Five Island Gin, nicknamed Five Ulcer Gin, in radio man Harry Brooks's gas mask holster. When an MP tapped Brooks's hip to check for the mask, the bottle broke and left Brooks with a soggy leg. It was probably for the best. Louis noticed that when he drank the stuff, his chest hair spontaneously fell out. He later discovered that Five Island Gin was often used as paint thinner. After that, he stuck to beer. Phil, like all airmen, had to cope with the possibility of dying, but he had an additional burden. As a pilot, he was keenly conscious that if he made a mistake, 8 other men could die. He began carrying 2 talismans. One was a bracelet Cece had given him. Believing that it kept him from harm, he wouldn't go up without it. The other was a silver dollar that jingled endlessly in his pocket. On the day that he finally ran away with Cece, he said, he'd use it to tip the bellboy. When I do get home, he wrote to her, I'm going to hide with you where no one will find us. In the early days of 1943, as men died one after another, every man dealt with the losses in a different way. Somewhere along the way, a ritual sprang up. If a man didn't return, the others would open his footlocker, take out his liquor, and have a drink in his honor. In a war without funerals, it was the best they could do. Chapter 9. 594 Holes. In February 1943, during a brief visit to the equatorial island of Canton, the Superman crew had its first encounter with exploding sharks. Canton was a seething purgatory in the shape of a pork chop, consisting mostly of coral and scrubby plants huddled close to the ground as if cringing from the heat. There was only one tree on the entire island. The surrounding waters were tumbling with sharks, which got trapped in the lagoon at low tide. Bored out of their wits, the local servicemen would tie garbage to long sticks and dangle them over the lagoon. When the sharks snapped at the bait, the men would lob hand grenades into their mouths and watch them blow up. The Superman crew had been sent to Canton for two missions over Japanese-occupied Makin and Tarawa in the Gilbert Islands. On the first mission, the lead plane made a wrong turn, and the men found themselves over Howland, the island that Amelia Earhart had been aiming for when she had vanished 6 years earlier. They noticed gouges in the Howland runway, the calling cards of the Japanese. Once they got sorted out and found Makin, Louis couldn't see his target through the clouds. They made three circles with no luck. So their colonel ordered them to drop the bombs anywhere and get going. Through a gap in the clouds, Louis spotted a row of outhouses, and with giggling glee, walloped them with 3,000 pounds of demolition bombs. To a cheer from the crew, the outhouses blew sky high. 2 days later, the men flew back to the Gilberts to photograph the islands, bringing a six-man camera crew. They buzzed several islands under fire, snapping photos. With Superman's nose bloodied from an anti-aircraft round, they turned back for Canton. 300 miles from home, Engineer Douglas made a discovery. Superman's eccentric fuel gauges, which had been jiggling around, had settled very low. Douglas announced that at their current rate, they wouldn't make Canton. Phil slowed the propellers as far as he dared and leaned the fuel mixture so that the least possible fuel was used. The crew shoved out almost everything that wasn't bolted down, and all 15 men crowded into the front of the plane in the belief that it would improve airspeed. Knowing that their chances of making Canton were slim, they considered Howland, but then recalled the pitted runway. They discussed ditching near Howland, but that raised the issue of sharks. In the end, they agreed to try for Canton. Wedged together in the front of the plane, all the men could do was wait. The sun set. Louis stared into the dark below and thought about what it would feel like to crash. The fuel gauges inched lower, and everyone waited to hear the engines sputtering out. At last, with the fuel gauges at absolute bottom, Phil spotted a searchlight craning around the sky and runway lights dotting the dark below. Realizing that he was way too high, Phil dropped the plane so sharply that Pillsbury bobbed into the air and hung there for a moment weightless before slapping down. As Superman touched down on Canton, its tail settled lower than it had been in the air, causing the last drops of fuel to shift back. A moment later, one engine quit. 2 weeks later, the men saw what would have awaited them had they gone down at sea. A B-25, flying off Oahu, radioed that it was low on fuel, then went silent. Superman was scrambled to hunt for it. After an hour and a half of searching, Louis spotted a curl of gray smoke. Two Catalina flying boats were heading toward it. Superman followed. When they arrived at the crash site, the men were astonished by what they saw. Two life rafts, holding the entire five-man B-25 crew, floated amid plane debris. Around them, the ocean was churning with hundreds of sharks, some of which looked 20 feet long. Knifing agitated circles in the water, the creatures seemed on the verge of overturning the rafts. The Catalinas reached the men before the sharks could, and the B-25 men treated their rescuers to drinks that night. But the Superman crew now understood the feelings of the grenade throwers on Canton. On a later flight, when they saw several sharks harassing six whales, they dove low over the water and shot at the sharks. Later, they felt guilty. On future flights, when they saw sharks, they let them be. Nauru was a little afterthought of land, 8 square miles of sand sitting alone in the Pacific, about 2,500 miles southwest of Hawaii. It was the kind of place that the world might have left alone, were it not for the 50,000 tons of high-grade phosphate that lay under the feet of the grass-skirted natives. A central ingredient in fertilizer and munitions, the phosphate had been discovered in 1900, and since then, the island had been home to a community of European businessmen and Chinese workers who mined the land. When the war began, Nauru became a priceless prize. Japan seized Nauru in August 1942, imprisoning the Europeans who had not fled and forcing the natives and the Chinese to mine phosphate and build a runway. They enforced their authority with the sword, beheading people for infractions as trivial as the theft of a pumpkin. When the runway was complete, Japan had a rich source of phosphate and an ideal base for airstrikes. On April 17th, upon returning from a run, Louis was called to a briefing. America was going after Nauru in a big way, sending Superman and 22 other B-24s to hit the phosphate works. No one in the squadron saw a bed that night. They left just before midnight, refueled on Canton, and flew to Funafuti, the tiny atoll from which they would launch their attack. They found it jostling with journalists brought in by the military to cover the raid. At a briefing, the crews were told to approach Nauru at 8,000 feet. The altitude gave Louis and the others pause. That week, they had made practice runs from 8,000 to 10,000 feet, and the potential for anti-aircraft fire to butcher them at that altitude had alarmed the whole crew. "We only hope," Louis had written in his diary 2 days earlier, "we don't bomb that low in actual combat." Pillsbury couldn't stop thinking about something else that the briefing officer had said. There would be 10 to 12 zeros waiting for them. He'd seen a distant zero at Wake, but had never been engaged by one. The idea of a single zero was daunting. The prospect of 12 scared him to death. Before dawn the next day, the men walked together to Superman. With them was a lieutenant named Donald Nelson. He wasn't on the crew, but asked if he could tag along so he could see combat. At 5 a.m., Superman was airborne. Dog-legging to the west to hide their point of origin, the planes took 6.5 hours to reach Nauru. No one spoke. Superman led the mass of bombers, flying with a plane on each wing. The sun rose, and the planes flew into a clear morning. The Japanese would see them coming. At about 20 past 11, Navigator Mitchell broke the silence. They'd be over the island in 15 minutes. In the greenhouse, Louis could just make out an apostrophe of land, flat to the horizon. Below, there was a black shadow in the water. It was an American submarine, ready to pick up survivors if bombers were shot down. Superman passed over it and slid over Nauru. Louis shivered. It was eerily silent. The first 9 planes, Superman out front, crossed the island unopposed. The air was very still, and the plane glided along without a ripple. Phil relinquished control to the Norden bombsite. Superman's first target, a knot of planes and structures beside a runway, came into view. Louis lined up on the gleaming backs of the planes. And then, shattering. The sky became a fury of color, sound, and motion. Flak hissed up, trailing streamers of smoke over the planes, then burst into black puffs, sparkling with shrapnel. Metal flew everywhere, streaking up from below and raining down from above. With the bombsite in control, Phil could do nothing. Something struck the bomber on Superman's left wing, piloted by Lieutenant John Jacobs. The plane sank as if drowning. At almost the same moment, the plane to Superman's right was hit. Just a few feet away, Pillsbury watched the bomber falter, drop, and disappear under Superman's wing. Pillsbury could see the men inside, and his mind briefly registered that all of them were about to die. Superman was alone. Louis kept his focus below, trying to aim for the parked planes. As he worked, there was a tremendous bang and a terrific shudder. Much of Superman's right rudder, a chunk the size of a dinner table, blew off. Louis lost the target. As he tried to find it again, a shell bit a wide hole in the bomb bay, and the plane rocked again. At last, Louis had his aim, and the first bombs dropped, spun down, and struck their targets. Then Superman passed over a set of red-roofed barracks and an anti-aircraft battery, Louis's second and third targets. Louis lined up and watched the bombs crunch into the buildings and battery. He had one bomb left for a target of opportunity. North of the airfield, he saw a shack and took aim. The bomb fell clear, and Louis yelled, "Bombs away!" and turned the valve to close the bomb bay doors. In the cockpit, the bomb release light flicked on, and Phil took control of the plane. As he did, behind and below the plane, there was a pulse of white light and an orb of fire. Louis had made a lucky guess and a perfect drop. The shack was a fuel depot, and he had struck it dead center. In the top turret, Pillsbury pivoted backward and watched a vast cloud of smoke billow upward. There was no time for celebration. Zeros were suddenly all around. Louis counted 9 of them, slashing around the bombers, machine guns blazing. The boldness and skill of the Japanese pilots astounded the bomber crews. The Zeros flew at the bombers head-on, cannons firing, slicing between planes that were just feet apart. They passed so close that Louis could see the faces of the pilots. Firing furiously, the bomber gunners tried to take out the Zeros. The shooting was all point-blank, and bullets were flying everywhere. One bomber sustained 17 hits from friendly planes, or possibly from its own waste guns. Stricken bombers began slipping behind, and the Zeros pounced. One bomber was hounded by four Zeros in a biplane. Its gunners shot down one Zero before their pilot found a cloud to hide in, scattering his pursuers. Below, Lieutenant Jacobs, Phil's lost wingman, was still airborne, his plane laboring along on three engines and no right rudder in a circle of Zeros. His gunner sent one Zero down. Thor Hamrin, pilot of the B-24 Jab in the Ass, saw Jacobs struggling. Circling back and speeding down, he opened up on the Zeros with all of his guns. The Zeros backed off, and Jacobs flew on with Hamrin on his wing. The first bombers, pursued by Zeros, headed out to sea. With its fighters gone and many of its guns destroyed, the Japanese base was left exposed. The trailing B-24s swept in, crossing through rivers of smoke to rain bombs on the phosphate plant. In the last plane over the island, a reporter raised his binoculars. He saw a volcano-like mass of smoke and fire, a burning Japanese bomber, a few bursts of anti-aircraft fire, and not a single moving person. Phil and Cuppernell pushed Superman full throttle for home. The plane was gravely wounded, trying to fly up and over onto its back. It wanted to stall and wouldn't turn, and the pilots needed all their strength to hold it level. Three Zeros orbited it, spewing streams of bullets and cannon shells. The gunners, engulfed in scalding hot spent cartridges, fired back. Mitchell in the nose, Pillsbury in the top turret, Glassman in the belly, Lambert in the tail, and Brooks and Douglas standing exposed at the broad, open waste windows. Louis, still in the greenhouse, saw rounds ripping through the Zeros' fuselages and wings, but the planes were relentless. Bullets streaked through Superman from every direction. In every part of the plane, the sea and sky were visible through gashes in the bomber's skin. Every moment, the holes multiplied. Just as Louis turned to leave the greenhouse, he saw a Zero dive straight for Superman's nose. Mitchell and the Zero pilot fired simultaneously. Louis and Mitchell felt bullets cutting the air around them, one passing near Mitchell's arm, the other just missing Louis's face. One round sizzled past and struck the turret's power line, and the turret went dead. At the same instant, Louis saw the Zero pilot jerk. Mitchell had hit him. For a moment, the Zero continued to speed directly at the nose of Superman. Then the weight of the stricken pilot on the yoke forced the Zero down, ducking under the bomber. The fighter powered down and splashed into the ocean just short of the beach. Louis rotated the dead turret by hand, and Mitchell climbed out. The gunners kept firing, and Superman trembled on. There were still two Zeros circling it. In the top turret, facing backward, Stanley Pillsbury had fearsome weapons. Twin 50-caliber machine guns. Each gun could fire 800 rounds per minute, the bullets traveling about 3,000 feet per second. Pillsbury's guns could kill a man from 4 miles away, and they could take out a Zero if given the chance. But the Zeros were staying below, where Pillsbury couldn't hit them. He could feel their rounds thumping into Superman's belly, but all he could see were his plane's wings. Fixated on the nearest Zero, Pillsbury thought, "If he just come up, I can knock him down." He waited. The plane groaned and shook. The gunners fired. The Zeros pounded them from below. And still, Pillsbury waited. Then Louis saw a Zero swoop up on the right. Pillsbury never saw it. The first he knew of it was an ear-splitting kabang, 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 a sensation of everything tipping and blowing apart, an excruciating pain. The Zero had sprayed the entire right side of Superman with cannon shells. The first rounds hit near the tail, spinning the plane hard on its side. Shrapnel tore into the hip and left leg of tail gunner Ray Lambert, who hung on sideways as Superman rolled. The plane's twist saved him. A cannon round struck exactly where his head had been an instant earlier, hitting so close to him that his goggles shattered. Ahead, shrapnel dropped Brooks and Douglas at the waste guns. In the belly turret, two hunks of shrapnel penetrated the back of Glassman, who was so adrenalized that he felt nothing. Another round hit the passenger Nelson. Finally, a shell blew out the wall of the top turret, disintegrating on impact and shooting metal into Pillsbury's leg from foot to knee. Half the crew and all of the working gunners had been hit. Superman reeled crazily on its side, and for a moment it felt about to spiral out of control. Phil and Coppernell wrenched it level. Clinging to his gun as the shrapnel struck his leg and the plane's spin nearly flung him from his seat, Pillsbury shouted the only word that came to mind. Ow! Louis heard someone scream. When the plane was righted, Phil yelled to him to find out how bad the damage was. Louis climbed from the nose turret. The first thing he saw was Harry Brooks in the bomb bay, lying on the catwalk. The bomb bay doors were wide open, and Brooks was dangling partway off the catwalk, one hand gripping the catwalk and one leg swinging in the air, with nothing but air and ocean below him. His eyes bulged, and his upper body was wet with blood. He lifted one arm toward Louis, a plaintive expression on his face. Louis grabbed Brooks by the wrists and pulled him into a seated position. Brooks slumped forward, and Louis could see holes dotting the back of his jacket. There was blood in his hair. Louis dragged Brooks to the flight deck and pulled him into a corner. Brooks passed out. Louis found a cushion and slid it under him, then returned to the bomb bay. He remembered having turned the valve to close the doors and couldn't understand why they were open. Then he saw. There was a slash in the wall, and purple fluid was splattered everywhere. The hydraulic lines, which controlled the doors, had been severed. With these lines broken, Phil would have no hydraulic control of the landing gear or the flaps, which they would need to slow the plane on landing. And without hydraulics, they had no brakes. Louis cranked the bomb bay doors shut by hand. He looked to the rear and saw Douglas, Lambert, and Nelson lying together, bloody. Douglas and Lambert were pawing along the floor, trying to reach their guns. Nelson didn't move. He'd taken a shot to the stomach. Louis shouted to the cockpit for help. Phil yelled back that he was losing control of the plane and needed Coppernell. Louis said that this was a dire emergency. Phil braced himself at the controls, and Coppernell got up, saw the men in back, and broke into a run. He found morphine, sulfa, oxygen masks, and bandages, and dropped down next to each man in turn. Louis knelt beside Brooks, who was still unconscious. Feeling through the gunner's hair, he found two holes in the back of his skull. There were four large wounds in his back. Louis strapped an oxygen mask to Brooks' face and bandaged his head. As he worked, he thought about the state of the plane. The waist, nose, and tail gunners were out. The plane was shot to hell. Phil was alone in the cockpit, barely keeping the plane up, and the Zeros were still out there. One more pass, he thought, will put us down. Louis was bending over Brooks when he felt a trickle on his shoulder, something dripping. He looked up and saw Pillsbury in the top turret. Blood was streaming from his leg. Louis rushed to him. Pillsbury was still in his seat, facing sideways, gripping the gun and sweeping his eyes around the sky. He looked absolutely livid. His leg dangled below him, his pant leg hanging in shreds and his boot blasted. Next to him was a jagged hole, the shape of Texas, and almost as large as a beach ball, clawed out of the side of the plane. The turret was shot with holes, and the floor was jingling with flakes of metal and turret motor. Louis began doctoring Pillsbury's wounds. Pillsbury, swinging his head back and forth, ignored him. He knew that the Zero would come back to finish the kill, and he had to find it. The urgency of the moment drove the pain into a distant place. Suddenly there was a whoosh of dark, close, upward motion, a gray, shining body, a red circle. Pillsbury shouted something unintelligible, and Louis let go of his foot just as Pillsbury banged the high-speed rotator on his turret. The turret grunted to life, whirling Pillsbury around 90 degrees. The Zero reached the top of its arc, leveled off, and sped directly toward Superman. Pillsbury was terrified. In an instant, the end would come with the most minute of gestures, the flick of the Zero pilot's finger on his cannon trigger, and Superman would carry 10 men into the Pacific. Pillsbury could see the pilot who would end his life, the tropical sun illuminating his face, a white scarf coiled about his neck. Pillsbury thought, I have to kill this man. Pillsbury sucked in a sharp breath and fired. He watched the tracers skim away from his gun's muzzle and punched through the cockpit of the Zero. The windshield blew apart and the pilot pitched forward. The fatal blow never came to Superman. The Zero pilot, surely seeing the top turret smashed and the waist windows vacant, had probably assumed that the gunners were all dead. He had waited too long. The Zero folded onto itself like a wounded bird. Pillsbury felt sure that the pilot was dead, before his plane struck the ocean. The last Zero came up from below, then faltered and fell. Clarence Douglas, standing at the waist gun, with his thigh, chest, and shoulder torn open, brought it down. In the ocean behind them, the men on the submarine watched the planes tussle over the water. One by one, the Zeros dropped, and the bombers flew on. The submarine crew would later report that not one Zero made it back to Nauru. It is believed that thanks to this raid and others, the Japanese never retrieved a single shipment of phosphate from the island. The pain that had been far away during the gunfight surged over Pillsbury. Louis pushed the release on the turret chair and the gunner slid into his arms. Louis eased him to the floor next to Brooks. Grasping Pillsbury's boot, he began easing it off as gently as he could. Pillsbury hollered for all he was worth. The boot slid off. Pillsbury's left big toe was gone. It was still in the boot. The toe next to it hung by a string of skin, and portions of his other toes were missing. So much shrapnel was embedded in his lower leg that it bristled like a pincushion. Louis thought that there would be no way to save the foot. He bandaged Pillsbury, gave him a shot of morphine, fed him a sulfur pill, then hurried away to see if they could save the plane. Superman was dying. Phil couldn't turn it from side to side with the normal controls, and the plane was pulling upward so hard, trying to flip, that Phil couldn't hold it with his arms. He put both feet on the yoke and pushed as hard as he could. The nose kept rearing up so high that the plane was on the verge of stalling. It was porpoising up and down. The men who could walk rushed through the plane, assessing its condition. The peril of their situation was abundantly clear. The right rudder was completely shot, a large portion of it missing and its cables severed. The cables for the elevators, which controlled the plane's pitch, were badly damaged. So were the cables for the trim, which gave the pilot fine control of the plane's altitude, its orientation in the air, and thus greatly reduced the effort needed to handle the plane. Fuel was trickling onto the floor under the top turret. No one knew the condition of the landing gear, but with the entire plane perforated, it was likely that the tires had been struck. The bomb bay was sloshing with hydraulic fluid. Phil did what he could. Slowing the engines on one side created a power differential that forced the plane to turn. Pushing the plane to higher speed eased the porpoising and reduced the risk of stalling. If Phil kept his feet on the yoke and pushed hard, he could stop the plane from flipping. Someone shot off the fuel feed near Pillsbury, and the leaking stopped. Louis took a bomb arming wire and spliced the severed rudder and elevator cables together. It didn't result in immediate improvement, but if the left rudder cables failed, it might help. Funafuti was 5 hours away. If Superman could carry them that far, they would have to land without hydraulic control of the landing gear, flaps, or brakes. They could lower the gear and extend the flaps with hand pumps, but there was no manual alternative to hydraulic brakes. Without bombs or much fuel aboard, the plane weighed some 40,000 pounds. A B-24 without brakes, especially one coming in hot, over the standard of 90 to 110 miles per hour landing speed, could eat up 10,000 feet before it stopped. Funafuti's runway was 6,660 feet long. At its end were rocks and sea. Hours passed. Superman shook and struggled. Louis and Coppernel moved among the injured men. Pillsbury lay on the floor, watching his leg bleed. Mitchell hunched over his navigation table, and Phil wrestled with the plane. Douglas limped about, looking deeply traumatized. His shoulder and arm, said Pillsbury, all torn to pieces. Brooks lay next to Pillsbury, blood pooling in his throat, making him gurgle as he breathed. Pillsbury couldn't bear the sound. Once or twice, when Louis knelt before him, Brooks opened his eyes and whispered something. Louis put his ear near Brooks's lips, but couldn't understand him. Brooks drifted off again. Everyone knew he was almost surely dying. No one spoke of it. It was likely they all knew that they'd crash on landing, if not before. Whatever thoughts each man had, he kept them to himself. Daylight was fading when the palms of Funafuti brushed over the horizon. Phil began dropping the plane toward the runway. They were going much too fast. Someone went to the hand crank on the catwalk and opened the bomb bay doors, and the plane, dragging on the air, began to slow. Douglas went to the pump for the landing gear just under the top turret. He needed two hands to work it, one to push the valve and one to work the pump, but he was in too much pain to hold up either of his arms for more than a few seconds. Pillsbury couldn't stand, but by stretching as far as he could, he reached the selector valve. Together, they got the gear down while Louis peered out the side window, looking for a yellow tab that would signify that the gear was locked. The tab appeared. Mitchell and Louis pumped the flaps down. Louis scrounged up parachute cord and went to each injured man, looping cord around him as a belt, then wrapping the rope around stationary parts of the plane. Nelson, with his belly wound, couldn't have a rope wrapped around his torso, so Louis fed the line around his arm and under his armpit. Fearing that they'd end up on fire, he didn't knot the cords. Instead, he wound the ends around the hands of the injured men so they could free themselves easily. The question of how to stop the bomber remained. Louis had an idea. What if they were to tie two parachutes to the rear of the plane, pitch them out of the waist windows at touchdown, and pull the ripcords? No one had ever tried to stop a bomber in this manner. It was a long shot, but it was all they had. Louis and Douglas placed one parachute in each waist window and tied them to a gun mount. Douglas went to his seat, leaving Louis standing between the waist windows, a ripcord in each hand. Superman sank toward Funafuti. Below, the journalists and the other bomber crews stood watching the crippled plane come in. Superman dropped lower and lower. Just before it touched down, Pillsbury looked at the airspeed gauge. It read 110 miles per hour. For a plane without brakes, it was too fast. For a moment, the landing was perfect. The wheels kissed the runway so softly that Louis stayed on his feet. Then came a violent gouging sensation. What they had feared had happened. The left tire was flat. The plane caught hard, veered left, and careened toward two parked bombers. Cuppernell, surely more out of habit than hope, stomped on the right brake. There was just enough hydraulic fluid left to save them. Superman spun in a circle and lurched to a stop just clear of the other bombers. Louis was still in the back, gripping the parachute cords. He had not had to use them. Douglas popped open the top hatch, dragged himself onto the roof, raised his injured arm over his head, and crossed it with his other arm, the signal that there were wounded men inside. Louis jumped down from the bomb bay and gave the same signal. There was a stampede across the airfield, and in seconds the plane was swarming with Marines. Louis stood back and ran his eyes over the body of his ruined plane. Later, ground crewmen would count the holes in Superman, marking each one with chalk, to be sure that they didn't count any twice. There were 594 holes. All of the Nauru bombers had made it back. Every one of them shot up, but none so badly as this. Brooks was laid on a stretcher, placed on a jeep, and driven to a rudimentary one-room infirmary. He was bleeding inside his skull. They carried Pillsbury to a barracks to await treatment. He was lying there about an hour later when the doctor came in and asked him if he knew Harry Brooks. Pillsbury said yes. He didn't make it, the doctor said. Technical Sergeant Harold Brooks died 1 week before his 23rd birthday. It took more than a week for word to reach his widowed mother, Edna, at 511 and a half Western Avenue in Clarksville, Michigan. Across town on Harley Road, the news reached his fiancée, Jeanette Bircher. She learned that he was gone 9 days before the wedding date that they had set before he left for the war.